Lecture 18, The Dalai Lama.
In our last lecture, we talked about the four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And at the very end of the lecture, I talked about the Gelug school and the founder of that school, whose name was Tsongkhapa. Now, I didn't get a chance to talk very extensively about Tsongkhapa and his tradition last time, and the reason for that is that we want to dig in this lecture more deeply into the significance of that school in Tibetan history. The Gelug school was represented by the lineage of the Dalai Lamas, and for many people, Tibetan Buddhism today is really personified and represented by the lineage of the Dalai Lamas. So this lecture is a chance for us to focus on probably the most visible single symbol of Tibetan Buddhism in the world, and perhaps the most visible and influential spokesman for Buddhism in any Buddhist tradition. The present Dalai Lama, who is the 14th in the line of Dalai Lamas, received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989 for his peaceful resistance to Chinese rule in Tibet. From his exile in India, the Dalai Lama has traveled around the world to champion the Tibetan cause and present Buddhist solutions to many of the problems that people feel we suffer from in one way or another in the modern world. So for us, in this course, he really functions as a bridge between the ancient cultural traditions of Tibet, the traditions that we've been talking about in the last two lectures, and all of the complex challenges that face people in any modern society in the 20th century. So let's start with a simple question, basic question. Who is the Dalai Lama? Who is this person who personifies for us, for so many of us, the Tibetan tradition? Tibetans believe that the present Dalai Lama is the 14th in a line of incarnations that goes back into the 14th century. And when the 13th Dalai Lama, his predecessor, died back in the mid-1930s, a bunch of Tibetan monks, authorities in Lhasa, and key figures in the government, searched for his reincarnation. Found a little boy up in northern Tibet and designated him as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama, brought him to Lhasa, and had him educated so that he could serve this function and play this role in the Tibetan tradition. Now, when I tell the story to you this way, the story of reincarnation, of discovering a new representative of an ancient lineage, raises a question for us about Tibetan Buddhism, about an aspect of Tibetan Buddhism that is quite different from anything that you likely to see in other religious traditions. It's the system called the Tulku system, or the system of reincarnation, of passing the authority in a lineage like this down, not from father to son or from teacher to student, but from one incarnation to another, each one of which has to be discovered by some process in the next generation. What is the Tulku system? What is a Tulku? What do we mean when we use this word? The word Tulku was used traditionally to refer to the so-called manifestation body of a Buddha. This is the body that a celestial Buddha manifests in this world. Celestial Buddha, as you know, lives in some celestial realm, a pure land or a heaven, and then manifests a form, a physical form, in this world. Here in the Tibetan context, it's used to refer to the form that a particular saint or a religious leader adopts when he or she is reborn in this world. The Tulku system is quite widespread in Tibetan Buddhism. I first went into my study of Tibetan Buddhism thinking that it was very rare and unusual to discover one of these reincarnations. But I was taught very soon that there actually are lots of incarnations in lots of different communities in Tibet. The way I learned this first was to go and visit a Gelug monastery down in South India where there was a major Tibetan refugee camp, and I had a camera. It was back in the 70s, and there weren't a lot of cameras around, and they asked me if I'd take a picture of all of the tulkus in the monastery. It wasn't a very big monastery. It turned out to be a pretty big group photo. There were at least half a dozen significant tulkus just in that small monastery. So there are lots of tulkus in the Tibetan tradition, and it's a widespread practice to deal in one way or another with the transmission of authority from one generation to the next. It also isn't associated just with the school of the Dalai Lamas. It's found in other schools, such as the Kagyu school that I mentioned in the last lecture. If you follow Tibetan Buddhism in the news, you'll know that there has been a hot controversy in the last few years about the reincarnation of a Kagyu Lama who is known as the Karmapa Lama. The previous Karmapa was quite influential and charismatic. He lived in Bhutan, he traveled widely in the West, and he exercised a lot of influence among Tibetan Buddhists, not just in the refugee community in India, but also through the Tibetan Buddhist communities in North America. And I can say, just in passing, that he was indeed a rather interesting person. I had one of my most wonderful encounters with a Tibetan teacher with the Karmapa just before his death. He was dying of stomach cancer. And he came to Harvard Divinity School to make a visit, and I, thinking that it was rare to see a Tibetan Lama of this significance and magnitude, I invited all of my class on Buddhism to go up and listen to him. And it was, truth be told, a rather sleepy talk, but he mentioned compassion and he mentioned wisdom and a lot of the themes that you'd expect him to mention in a talk about the basic ideas of his tradition. And afterwards, he was to hold an audience. So he sat down in one of the lounges and we all were ushered in one by one to speak to him. And it's hard to make small talk with a Lama who is as influential as this, but I said to him, wise Karmapa, I brought my class to visit you today. I was talking about compassion with them this morning as we were talking about the ideal of the Bodhisattva, and I was delighted that they had a chance to hear about compassion from such an influential and wise figure as you. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "Professor Eckel, I want you to know that whenever you speak about compassion, I will be standing behind you." Now, this is a man who was supposed to have very powerful influence over the course of karmic events in the world, and I have always just peeked around behind me whenever I mention the word compassion, just to see if the Karmapa is present. You should keep an eye out for him, too, just in case he happens to manifest himself in these lectures. Now, shortly after that meeting, he died. Shortly after I had a chance to meet him, he died. And, of course, the search started for his reincarnation. And it turned out, as often happens in the Tibetan tradition, there were competing reincarnations. One was found in Bhutan and another was found in Tibet, representing different parties in the followers and associates of the Karmapa. Just a couple of years ago, the Tibetan reincarnation of the Karmapa, in a hair-raising and adventurous escape, managed to get over the Himalayas and into India and presented himself to the Dalai Lama in India as the authoritative representative of this tradition. He's just a young man, a teenager. And it turned out, actually, that he has become a rather influential and respected figure, even at a young age. He has a certain kind of authority that I can imagine. I can certainly imagine having known his predecessor in this lineage. And some people think that he may very well be a very important leader in the Tibetan community in the next generation. So there are lots of tulkus in the Tibetan tradition, and they occupy a very special position of authority throughout the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, returning to the Dalai Lama himself, the first person to be recognized retrospectively as a Dalai Lama was a disciple of Tsongkhapa whose name was Gendun Drukpa, who was born in the year 1391, so he lived in the 14th and 15th centuries. The title Dalai Lama was not given until later in the development of the lineage. It was given to the third Dalai Lama, whose name was Sonam Gyatso, by the Mongol leader Altan Khan. The title Dalai Lama means ocean lama And it seems to suggest to most people that the Dalai Lama possesses an ocean of wisdom. With the title came Mongol support in the power struggles that eventually made the Dalai Lamas not only the leaders of the Gelugpa school, but also the spiritual and temporal rulers of Tibet. Now, obviously, this is an unusual combination. We haven't seen this before in our study of Buddhism. Usually, Buddhist monks avoid getting themselves involved directly in politics. In fact, there are lots of very marvelous examples of Buddhist monks who were drawn into politics inadvertently by the actions of various kings or political leaders and quite dramatically withdrew in order to keep a distance between their own monastic practice and the political life that was going on around them. But Buddhism has always had a strong political side, of course. We've talked about that a lot over the course of these lectures. This political involvement in the Buddhist tradition has been associated particularly with the figure of the Dharmaraja, or the righteous king. And the first of these, or the first definitive, most influential of these, was Ashoka, the king who lived back only a couple of centuries or so after the death of the Buddha. Now, you could think of the Dalai Lama, this is not inaccurate to think of him in this way, as one of the few figures in Buddhist history who has brought the ideal of the righteous king, of the political leader, the king who protects the community and promulgates the Dharma. He's brought this ideal together with the ideal of the charismatic monk in one person. So the Dalai Lama, in some ways, is the unique figure that he is and the powerful figure that he is because he is able to unite the political side of Buddhism with the monastic side. Makes him complex, but it also makes him influential in a way that would not be found in other aspects of the Buddhist tradition. The transition from purely monastic power to what we are calling temporal power, political power in the secular affairs of Tibet, was accomplished by one of the great figures in this lineage, the so-called Great Fifth Dalai Lama, fifth in the lineage, who lived from 1617 to 1683. So he lived in the 17th century when the pilgrims were making their way over here to America. The fifth Dalai Lama outmaneuvered his rivals with the help of a Mongol prince, and he established Gelug political dominance over Tibet. This had not been done before, and the fifth Dalai Lama was the figure who really made this possible. And as a symbol of his authority, he built that great palace in Lhasa. It's known as the Potala Palace, that is, I think, in so many ways, a symbol of the lineage of the Dalai Lamas, and for many people, I think, a symbol of Tibet. I suspect that most of you have some kind of a visual image of it in your heads. It's really an important focus of pilgrimage in the Tibetan tradition, and a place that a lot of Buddhist travelers would very much like to have a chance to see. When you go to Lhasa, when I was there a couple of years ago, what you do very often, normal way to approach the old part of the city is to go down a long boulevard it's now called Beijing Boulevard, built by the Chinese authorities, and then you go past a small stupa in between two hills, and up on the left-hand side rises the Potala Palace, dominating a big square. It's a very traditional structure in a lot of ways. It's made out of stone and it's massive. In the old days, and during great festival events in Lhasa, people would, or monks would, hang great hangings off the front of the Potala. It's an enormous long stone ramp in the front of it that would be very suitable for that kind of thing. What I'm struck by when I see it, when I see pictures of it, and also when I was standing there in person, fairly lightheaded from my first encounter with the altitude in Tibet, I'm struck by how massive it is, of course, how much it sits down so firmly on the ground, but also how it sits almost as if it's an architectural version of an old Buddhist statue. It also has a little bit of that buoyancy of the Buddha. So it sits firmly on the ground and it also seems to float. Sometimes the Tibetans even describe it as a bird with two wings on the side and then one massive palatial structure in the center. So it's a remarkable and I think very effective architectural symbol of not just the Dalai Lama's, of course, and the power and imagination of the great fifth, but also of the Tibetan tradition itself. This palace has been the traditional seat of the Dalai Lamas until the Chinese occupation of Tibet in the early 1950s, and it still is a major goal of pilgrimage in the Tibetan tradition and truly an impressive monument. The first Dalai Lama to become enmeshed in international politics was the 13th Dalai Lama, who lived from 1876 to 1935. He tried to isolate Tibet from what was then known as the Great Game, the political struggle that took place between Russia and Britain for influence in Central Asia. The British, even though we often imagine them as being enormously powerful in India, felt often that their control of India was tenuous and might easily slip away, and they were very much concerned about being undermined by the expansion of Russian influence in Central Asia. So they sent messages in the early part of the 20th century up to Tibet, trying to find some way to enlist Tibetan support or at least to ensure Tibetan neutrality in this tug of war between the Russians and the British. Tibetans, as you might imagine, weren't particularly interested in answering their mail because they didn't want to get drawn into this political struggle between the Russians and the British. So the British, to try to get a response, sent a military expedition up to Lhasa, through Sikkim and up through the great fortress in Gyantse and eventually into Lhasa. It was led by a Colonel Young Husband, and it's referred to often as the Young Husband Expedition. It was a subject of an awful lot of romantic speculation, as you can imagine, in the British press at the time, because they felt that they were really opening up a very mysterious part of the world. In some ways, as those early travelers and early explorers said, the last undiscovered and unexplored area of the world, at least from the European point of view, that they represented. The Dalai Lama fled when the Young Husband Expedition came in, but the British forced a settlement with the representatives of the Dalai Lama who were still present. And from that time through the 20th century until the coming of the Chinese in the 50s, the British kept a diplomatic mission in Tibet that served at least in part as one of the as a means of communication between the Tibetans and the outside world, and provided for us as scholars of Tibet an early and important glimpse what was going on in Tibetan society in that time. Now, the weight of international responsibility and the real difficulty of trying to work through conflict with great powers fell most heavily not on the 13th Dalai Lama, but on the 14th Dalai Lama, the one who is alive today and is the symbol of Tibetan Buddhism for many. His name, the name of the 14th Dalai Lama, is Tenzin Gyatso, and he was born in 1935 in Amdo in northern Tibet, a region that was under the control of the Chinese. The story of the discovery of the Dalai Lama is one that's reasonably well known. It's told in the Dalai Lama's autobiography, and it's one that's well worth retelling. It tells something about his personality and something about the function of traditional Tibetan society. When the previous Dalai Lama died, the reins of power were handed over in Tibet to a regent, and the regent became responsible for setting in motion a process that would find a successor to the previous Dalai Lama. And he, being a practitioner and a monk, went down to a lake in southern Tibet and meditated until he had a vision of a place that might be likely as a possible site for the rebirth of this great figure. It turned out it was a small village with a farmhouse in a barren site in northern Tibet, with particular characteristics. And he sent a group of monks up into this region to look for a likely child. They visited the farmhouse of the young boy who became the 14th Dalai Lama, disguised, not as the grand figures that they were, but as simple monks. And they presented to this child a test. They had brought things that belonged to the previous Dalai Lama, small objects that only the Dalai Lama himself would know, and mixed them together with other objects that had belonged to other people, lined them up on the table, and asked the boy to select the things that were his. The story that's told, of course, is that with some kind of uncanny accuracy, he managed to select out exactly the things that had belonged to him in a previous life. With one exception, there was one object that he hesitated over, and they discovered later that it was an object that, sure, it had been in his possession in a previous life, but it was unclear that it really belonged to him. So they interpreted this as meaning that that memory of some questionable ownership was carried on into the next life. In any case, they identified this child, of course, as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama and brought him back to Lhasa to be trained as a monk along with his family. In 1950, when this Dalai Lama was only 15 years old and really hadn't come into full authority in Lhasa, after the Second World War, the Chinese armies attacked and occupied Tibet. As I mentioned earlier, China has felt for many centuries that the Chinese regime, as the heir of the Mongols, has inherited political authority over Tibet. And this has been as true in the 20th century as it was in earlier centuries, so that when the communist government solidified its power in China and began to expand its influence into other areas of China, Tibet was a natural place for them to expand their influence. So Chinese armies attacked and occupied Tibet. It wasn't terribly difficult to do. The Tibetan army wasn't terribly strong or very well trained or really even very numerous, so the Chinese were able quite easily to come in and take over central Tibet. The Dalai Lama stayed there for a while and negotiated with the Chinese, but then in 1959, there was a Tibetan uprising against the Chinese, and the Dalai Lama fled to India and established his home in exile in the town of Dharamsala in northern India. And he lives there today. That's the base for his travels around the rest of the world. Now, the Dalai Lama is interesting to us, I think, of course, not just because he represents this traditional lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, but also because he has articulated for us a particularly powerful and eloquent vision of Buddhism in the modern world. And that's the last thing that I'd like to discuss in the time we have in this lecture on the Dalai Lama. How does Buddhism look to him? When he has a chance to present Buddhism to us, what does it look like? What issues does he focus on? What problems does he particularly think are important to try to solve? And what can we take away from his teaching that will help us understand Buddhism in a simpler and more intuitive way, perhaps, than some of the complexities of the tradition that we've encountered in our historical survey of India and Tibet? I often find when I listen to the Dalai Lama speaking about Buddhism, especially to an audience that isn't one that he's worked with in great detail before, but just one that he's encountering for the first time, I find that he starts with that first point. It's important in the Four Noble Truths. He's concerned about the removal of suffering, especially in his recent speeches, the ones that have been coming in the last couple of years. He says, really, you know, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to find a way to remove suffering. He also is very skillful in the way he uses phrases often from political documents that are important in other cultures. He says, really, everyone has the right to pursue happiness, the right for the pursuit of happiness. And what we as Buddhists are trying to do is to facilitate that process, simply to let people be happy and to remove their suffering. It seems very simple in a lot of ways, and almost the kind of thing that would be so simple you wouldn't expect it from as sophisticated a person as the Dalai Lama. And yet it starts you right out at that key point where Buddhists always begin. All is suffering. What can we do to try to remove it? So I suspect if you look at the Dalai Lama's speeches, or if you have a chance to encounter him in person as he travels through North America or the rest of the world, this is where you will hear him start. We suffer and we want to be happy. And then he often stresses the increasing interdependence of the human community. Not just the interdependence of phenomena that make up the human personality, but the interdependence of all human beings in the world. This is an important theme for him. This reflects the image of interdependent co-arising that lies behind the second of the Noble Truths. But it often has a political spin and a spin that ties him and his own aspirations together with the aspirations of other people in the rest of the world. When he offers positive solutions to the problem of suffering, he often builds his moral arguments on the foundation of the Bodhisattva's compassion. In fact, if you want to know what compassion sounds like and what kind of arguments you can use to promote compassion in the world, the Dalai Lama is not a bad place to go. He speaks simply, he speaks eloquently, but his arguments come right straight out of the ancient tradition of India. There are two particular arguments that he often uses as what you might call tools of meditation for the development of compassion. One is an old Indian ideal of visualizing everybody in the universe as being your mother in a previous life. How could you not express compassion to your mother and feel some sense of connectedness to her? If everyone has been your mother in a previous life, there is a deep bond of sympathy and compassion that you can build on in your relationships. This old form of meditation is something that connects well with him, and he preaches it eloquently to his audiences. He also uses a funny, more technical meditation on compassion that's well worth thinking about. It comes from an 8th century Buddhist text in India. It's called the Exchange of Self and Other. He says, if you feel anger, if you feel envy, there's almost something tantric about this, the way it's presented often in traditional texts. If you feel anger, if you feel envy, if you feel even a certain kind of destructive rage against other people, don't feel it on your own behalf toward others. But let them feel it toward you. Put yourself in their shoes and feel that anger toward yourself. It's a funny way of taking anger and not denying it, but transmuting it, recognizing that it's there, but using it as a tool to try to develop some compassionate bond between people. Very interesting idea, and it's one that he often uses, especially in his relations with the Chinese. He's very fond of saying that he's grateful to the Chinese for having taught him patience and given him an opportunity to meditate on the virtues of compassion. Another thing that the Dalai Lama often does that you may encounter if you try to seek him out in a more technical Tibetan setting is to give initiations into a tantric teaching known as the Kala Chakra Tantra. This is a particular tantra that comes from a late period in India, and it has to do with establishing the sovereignty of the Dharma over a particular space. The Dalai Lama is a political leader, and I think often he, in subtle ways, attempts to convey his sense of political authority through the teaching of the Kala Chakra Tantra. It gets people thinking about him not just as a religious teacher, but as somebody who embodies in many respects the solid power and strength of the Dharma Raja. The Dalai Lama also makes important statements about significant public issues, and it's intriguing to see which ones he selects as being particularly noteworthy. Human rights are important for him, of course. Why? Because one of the things that he wants very much to do is establish the human rights of the Tibetan people, their right to some form of autonomy or self-determination. He also is concerned about the exploitation of the environment. This is a theme we haven't talked about very much in Indian and Tibetan Buddhism previously, but it's a theme that's significant for the Dalai Lama. And then, of course, he's very much concerned about the oppression of minority peoples, as you would expect from his Tibetan experience. Now, from the Chinese point of view, he's not necessarily a benign figure because he represents in the modern world this nascent Tibetan aspiration for self-determination. But I feel that for us as students of Buddhism, he is a remarkable embodiment of this tradition and one well worth listening to, well worth getting to know better in order to understand how this tradition can be brought to the issues of contemporary life.